Did you see the thing I said about smelting? I was like, excuse me, what?
There are some very particular traditions associated with smelting, are there not?
Like I said, I had some of those memories that were fond and some that were not so fond.
That sounds like an innuendo for sex. What are we talking about?
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time. This is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Hello, Wisconsin! Welcome to the noon hour. Thank you for joining us on your lunch hour today on this Monday, March 6th. And we are very excited for our next topic. But first, just a reminder, there's only 29 days until the spring election. We are, as of tomorrow, 4 weeks away.
Super important.
In case those political ads have not reminded you yet that it is upon us. It is a sprint to the election. You can check out everything, all things voting, on myvote.wi.gov. I checked this morning. You can see everything that's on your ballot. You can see, if you haven't gotten your absentee ballot request in, you can do that. You can check your registration. You can still register to vote until March 15th online. All of your things you can get done there, but 4 weeks from tomorrow. So, topically, our guests this hour, or this segment, are helping other people who are living abroad still vote and vote in Wisconsin. And so our guests are both from Democrats Abroad. Annie Grawl is on the Wisconsin State team and is coming in from Barcelona, Spain. And Liz Blackburn is also Wisconsin Abroad team member, and she is calling from China. So what time is it there, ladies?
2 a.m. in Shanghai. Anything for Wisconsin.
And Annie?
7 p.m. here.
Wow. And it is noon here. Thank you for, especially Liz. This was, are you usually up this late or is it just special for us?
This is how we get out the vote. And we're big fans. You probably didn't know you had worldwide following, but here we are. Annie said, hey, let's reach out. I really like these guys.
Oh, well, we're so yeah, and it was true. Us. I think it was on Twitter that Annie and I got connected as far as Wisconsin Dems Abroad. And I said, come on the show. Let's talk about it, because I feel like we sometimes are navel gazers and just thinking about the people in Wisconsin, trying to get them to vote. But I think we lose sight of how many people are voting who are still registered to vote in Wisconsin, still legally allowed to vote in Wisconsin, and yet live in China or live in Spain or live all over the world. And so let's talk more, I guess, first, just what Democrats Abroad is and does.
Sure. So Democrats Abroad is one of the 57 state parties of the DNC. So the DNC actually includes all 50 states, plus the six territories, and then Democrats Abroad. And we have 8 voting members who go to the Democratic Convention to vote for the candidate for president. And we hold our own global presidential primary every four years. So we're actually an official part of the Democratic Party.
And kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
It really is a big deal.
Realize that it was basically the same status as each state and the different territories. This is news to me.
Yep. And our number one mission is getting out the vote among overseas Americans, because all U.S. citizens have the right to vote, but a lot of people who live abroad don't know they have that right, or if they know they do, they don't know how to do it. So our mission is to help those people cast their vote every 4 years or every 2 years and make sure that they can exercise their right as citizens.
And so, because my first question becomes, when we think about, and this is all elections, this is not just presidential or midterms, like in local elections, obviously, like the one that's coming up. So as long as they're registered to vote at an address in Wisconsin, they can still vote for school boards, they can vote for mayor, they can vote for county boards and everything?
You want to take this part, Liz?
Oh, boy. Well, this is where it gets a little complicated.
Okay.
Wisconsin Wisconsin prides itself, if you look at the MOVE Act, which Annie will maybe touch on later, Military and Overseas Voter Act, on being super progressive and empowering to us abroad. They give us our ballots via fax or email or snail mail, as per the usual, and they think that speeds up time for us. But actually, there's a few little hurdles in between, like intending to return. Now, when you live abroad, you have to usually have a visa to live abroad, right? And so those get renewed, like in China, every year. So it might be in my mind that I want to return and I'm going to move back to Wisconsin this summer. I love summer in Wisconsin. I might be here or sitting in Paris and saying, hey, I'm good for a while. I don't know if I intend to return, or I might never return. I'm going to retire here. Well, that changes if you can vote on what in Wisconsin? At the state and local level. It also potentially impacts taxes. That's another thing. It's a little different per person, but really that intend to return is something that is a big part of our work at Wisconsinites Abroad. So if you intend to return like I do, you can vote in these state and local elections.
Interesting. So yeah, I would imagine that is a lot of what you as an organization do, is clarifying questions for people as they come up and say, I want to vote. Where do I fall of what I can vote in, how I get my information? And so is that a huge part of this for you, both of you?
Well, absolutely. And with that first question, how long do you intend to, you know, have this podcast, right? What's your 5-year plan? Think about that and answering that when you're filling out, do I want to register to vote against, say, this MAGA candidate who's an election denier? Kind of a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. So what are some of the other challenges that we don't, as people who live here, don't necessarily think of as far as whether it's the United States or Wisconsin specifically as like obstacles to voting when you are living abroad?
So the thing about voting for, as a U.S. citizen from overseas, our right to vote is protected by a law that's called UOCAVA, and that was approved in 1986 and signed into law actually by President Reagan, and it covers the right to vote from abroad of U.S. overseas military, their family members, and all other private U.S. citizens who are living abroad. So federally, the right to vote is protected by this law. And then all 50 states have their own interpretation from there on down because the states are who administer the elections. So as Democrats Abroad, we can help our members or any other overseas citizens who want to help, who want to vote. We can help them to register to vote in federal elections. The problem is when they come to the state-specific questions. And that's why in 2020, we started to form these teams that are state-specific because our volunteers were being asked to learn election laws for 50 different jurisdictions, basically. And it was just way too much for them to know. So now we have, for the most important swing states, and the decisive states like Florida, New York, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, we have state teams now. And we're helping our members to jump through all the hoops in the right order so that they can vote, because it's not easy. So one of the challenges that we have is getting our ballots back. The UOCAVA provisions were modified in 2009 by a second amendment that was called MOVE, the Military and Overseas Voter Empowerment Act. And that act provided for our ballots to be sent to us by email, because before that, they were sent to us by postal mail. And for somebody like Liz, who lives in China, where the mail is not necessarily always real reliable, it wasn't always possible to receive your ballot, fill it out, and get it back in time. Wisconsin is the state that requires all ballots to be returned by postal mail, which in 2020 during the pandemic was another really big challenge because a lot of the mail systems weren't even working. So one of the things that we have to work around is getting our ballots back in time. The MOVE Act allows for our ballots to be sent to us by email if we request to have them sent by email, but we still have to stick them in an envelope and send them back by postal mail. In 2020, the U.S. legislature, or the Wisconsin legislature, passed a law saying that every voter had to return their ballot personally, You couldn't return anybody else's mm-hmm. ballot for you. That's ballot harvesting, right? So think about somebody who lives in Panama that has really bad mail service right now, and they have three people in the same house. They have to all send their ballots back separately. And if that involves using FedEx to ensure that your ballot's going to get back, that involves spending $50 per ballot to go back, because you can't even sit them and send them back in the same envelope because of ballot harvesting. So there's a lot of...
What you're not being able to see, unless you're watching the live stream, both Jane and I are like slack-jawed right now of like having to spend that much money just in order to vote.
It almost feels like don't want people to be able to vote easily. It's just so odd.
It's like a poll tax.
100%. You know, it's exactly what it is. And in your February 2022 breakdown, where you asked, how long did you stand in that poll, you know, in that waiting line, waiting to vote on the 21st in that primary? We're waiting weeks. First, we have to get that ballot to drop. And in federal elections, that's 45 days before an election that it could drop via email, much longer if it's a mail request. And then it takes 5-6 weeks, if we're lucky, to get our mail back home, even if we use a consular pouch. In 2021, it cost me $63 to courier my, which is FedEx, DHL, what have you, UPS, to get my ballot to the primary election counters in District 1, where I vote in Wisconsin, $63. And then I used the fall for the general election, I went through the consulate. And not only, you know, did I get it in the very first day I got my ballot, the day it dropped, I believe, was September 24th, 45 days before that election. I went in that first Monday, dropped it to drop at the consulate. It still took 5 weeks to get to Wisconsin. Goes from a secure, like, steel pouch, they call it. It's a steel box with an American flag on it. It's pretty cool. And they send it directly in their secure consular pouch straight to the U.S., and then it gets delivered by the Postal Service to Joy, what have you. It takes forever. So are we looking at $63? Are we looking at 6 weeks? Maybe it doesn't get counted. Are we looking at Wisconsin legislatures who are looking to limit that time frame for military voters from 6 weeks to 4 weeks, et cetera? We got a lot on our plate.
You guys have on your plate. And so we have to take a break right now, but we're going to keep you both through the break, through the commercial, because I still want to hear what those of us living here can do to make your jobs a little bit easier. We're talking to Annie Grawl and Liz Blackborn, who are both from Democrats Abroad, one in China, one in Spain. Stick with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere. And we are talking to two Wisconsin team members of Democrats Abroad, Annie Grawl and Liz Blackborn. And we are talking about some of the hurdles it takes for people who you don't necessarily think about the hurdles they have to go through, but people who can legally vote and still want to vote in Wisconsin elections, in federal U.S. elections, presidential elections. But sometimes there's some barriers to do that. And so as far as what you would like people still living at home to know, or what the ways that they could help, because actually, before I ask that question, what is the rough estimate, at least people that you all work with the Wisconsin team, or even the numbers as far as people? Because I think on the website it said 9 million people living abroad that are trying to vote. Or what are some of the numbers that we should be aware of?
Yeah, this is tough because there isn't really any official number. So you see a lot of different numbers bouncing around. There's a government publication that's called the Election Administration and Voting Survey for 2020. And in that year, they said that there were 1.4 million military, plus 600,000 spouses and adult children, plus 2.9 million other citizens living abroad who could vote in that election. So you know, some of those larger numbers probably also include people who are too young to vote. Mm-hmm. But those would be people of voting age. And so of those people, 1.2 million requested their overseas ballot using the UOQAVA procedure, which is the correct procedure that we're supposed to use. And of those, less than 1 million were actually returned in time and counted. So there's a big gap there still.
Yeah.
And the main reason that ballots are rejected is because they don't make it back in time, which is going back to what Liz was talking about before, about the challenges of getting our ballots returned in time. But, you know, one thing I really want to stress is that even though it's hard for us to vote, it's really important for us to vote, because we are U.S. citizens and we carry U.S. passports and we travel through the world as Americans. And we also have to file taxes, even though we live in other countries. We have responsibilities as Americans. So we also have the right, and the right to vote is the most important right that we have.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I was just making a joke the other day as far as, because we vote a lot in Wisconsin. I mean, we have primaries, we have nonpartisan primaries, and then generals, we have partisan primaries and then generals. And so as someone who is also in the get out the vote game, it's like every 6 months. And so it's to do that with the added, everyone's remote, everyone lives in different countries, there's different rules for everyone. But I think before we talk about what people at home can do, what is, granted, it may not happen, but what would solve that major problem of ballots getting back in time? In both of your views?
Electronic returns would help a lot.
Yeah.
So there are 50 states that are covered by the UOQAVA legislation. 30 of those states now have electronic returns. All 50 send the ballots out by email, but only 30 of the states allow the ballots to be returned electronically. The other 20, of which Wisconsin is one, require mail return. So that would be the most important way of getting our ballots back in time.
It seems so easy. We have the technology.
It's just a silly stumbling block. You can send them out one way and that's perfectly fine, but you can't send them back that way because God only knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
All right. So then I guess for people who are listening to this, who would like to help in one way or another, what could they do? What should they know?
Go ahead, Liz.
Yeah, so right now we've got tons of people around the world who are working abroad temporarily or whatever, who have children abroad, who are studying, living, whatever, who are retired abroad. We need them to know to go to vote from abroad so they register. Wisconsin, you have to register and request your ballot every year. You might still be on the voter rolls, but if you don't request that ballot, you don't hit that deadline, as you know, is March 15th, you don't get that ballot. Mm-hmm. That's a big one. And this election is particularly important because it's a state and local election. You don't get a 45-day ballot in advance. So we have to tell voters to fill out a federal write-in ballot. We call it the FWAB or the FWAB, depending on where you're from. And it is ridiculous. You have to go through. It's a blank ballot. It's actually very helpful. But we've got to tell Sconnies what's on their ballot to begin with. If you're in District 8, did you know you have that extra election? Do you know if you have a school board election? Did you see those ridiculous last minute allowed motions that are going to be voted on in different counties and cities? Yeah, both of them. Shaking your head. It's ridiculous. So we got to tell people what's out there. And we've got some great resources on our website, democratsabroad.org/WI-USA. We got all you need for 2023, including that FWAB guide. We also have a guide about your envelopes, because not only can you and your spouse or your kids not put your ballots in the same envelope to return it, you got to use more than one. You have to have a secure envelope with your information inside. And then you have to have an envelope outside of that envelope. I mean, signatures
and a witness.
And witnesses and, oh my goodness, there's a lot. You got to go to our website. You got to go to Vote From Abroad and get everyone to fill out an FWAP today.
Or just
that
fly.
That is a big goal.
Or just fly or just home for Pete's sake.
That sounds even easier.
Pain in the neck.
All right. Well, we will connect. Feel free. I think I have everything, but feel free to follow up with me and send me all the information you would like for us to link to our show notes for today's episode, because this is super important. Like you said, friends who are living abroad, students who are studying abroad, people who you know would still want to vote. Let's get them, because we don't run out of time. Like we said, we only got 4 weeks. So let's get that information out. Liz Blackborn, Annie Grawl, thank you so much for spending time with us today. This was super informative.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for keeping up the fight.
All right, Liz, go get some sleep. It's 2 a.m. there. All right, when we come back, Scott Gerard and Jesse O'Poyan will join us to talk about school funding. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
It'll all be all right. I'll be home tonight. I'm coming back home. I can see you in the morning when you go to school. Don't forget your books, you know you've got to learn the golden rule. The teacher tells you stop your playing, get on with your work. And be like Johnny Toogood, don't you know he never shirks, he's coming along.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere.
It's a classic.
It is a classic, but it's
super.
It's
super tramp.
Such a cryptic start.
It's super tramp. It's cool.
It is cool. It is cool, Jane. All right. Well, if you can guess on what the Easter egg is with that song, we are going to be talking about school funding, which hangs in the balance of the Wisconsin budget debate. And here to talk about it are Scott Gerard, who is a K-12 education reporter for the Cap Times, and Jesse O'Poyan, who is the Capitol Bureau chief, because they wrote, it's been a month already, but they wrote an exhaustive piece that I found to be very informative as someone who hasn't lived here for this is longer than the last 15 years, but the article starts with a quote from 2005 when then deputy superintendent said to state leaders he's been trying to find the promised land in school finance for at least 3 decades. And that deputy superintendent at the time was Tony Evers. And so this is a conversation as far as our schools, what types of schools, funding, how we fund them that has been going on for a very long time. And right now we have an opportunity potentially with Governor Evers' budget to add $2 billion to the budget. If we get there, we will see. But I'm so excited to have you both here to kind of talk through what is sometimes a very nuanced, winding road of how we even got here in the first place.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We're glad to be here. It is a long and winding road for sure.
I mean, because for both of you, this is probably, what were both of you doing in 2005? Not working for the Cap Times, I'm imagining.
Well, obviously. Yeah. I guess that was my freshman or sophomore year of high school.
I was, a freshman and sophomore at La Follette High School here in Madison.
There you go. So we're all public school kids from Wisconsin.
Yep.
There
yep.
you go. So I guess let's talk about it from that point of view then. Like, there is a lot of reasons why we got to where we are now, which is, I think it's, depending on who you ask, we're underfunding the schools, at least in the way that it is not kept up with inflation. And so what kind of, and either both of you can take a stab at this, but like, how would you categorize the major milestones of how we got to where we are today?
Scott, I'll let you take that.
All right. Yeah. So back in the early 1990s is probably the most important milestone, which is when revenue caps were implemented. And at the time, Governor Tommy Thompson talked about, you know, what he considered skyrocketing property taxes and wanting to rein those in. And so revenue caps were an approach to do that. And what they did was basically set a maximum amount that school districts, one source said they're called revenue caps, they're really spending caps. Mm-hmm. Revenue caps, is a confusing term, but really they govern how much money school districts can spend, mostly through the combination of state aid and local property taxes. And so that was a whole new system. A couple years into that, they were tied to inflation. So annually, the revenue cap would increase by whatever the consumer price index was. And so that sort of gave school districts a way to plan. You know, they knew there was a set number that they knew their budget would increase by. Then in just before 2010, and actually just before sort of Act 10, which is obviously its own major barometer in the education world here in Wisconsin, but just before that, actually, under Governor Jim Doyle during the recession, they untied it from the rate of inflation. And so that meant that every 2 years with this biennial budget process that the state is doing right now, legislators decided how much to increase revenue caps or to not increase them if they chose not to. And so that has that to me is probably the most significant milestone for where we're at today, because it created a system where every 2 years schools aren't certain what sort of money they'll be able to spend, not only what state aid they'll receive and how that'll balance with property taxes, but literally how much they're going to be able to spend. And so that to me was probably the most significant change. And then obviously Act 10 happened and some cuts in school budgets and things like that.
And I think what stood out to me in the article you guys published is with the not tying with inflation and the having to adjust and plan and know that it could change every 2 years and the disruption that can create for schools and school boards in their long-term planning becomes the guessing game that can, you know, affect innovation and, like I said, long-term planning. And so with that, I mean, because there's also then the part of this that also the school voucher thing came into play during this as well. And so I don't know, Jesse, if you want to touch on that as far as how much do you feel like the voucher thing is something separate or can't be, it's still inextricably tied with like the funding issues that we're dealing with?
Yeah, I mean, there's a really big push and pull dynamic, I think. And vouchers weren't always a strict partisan issue. You definitely, I think, in years past had a lot more Democrats, particularly in the Milwaukee area, who are more supportive of those programs. But, you know, like a lot of issues over time, it's become, for the most part, a pretty partisan issue, at least if you look at it within the state legislature. You know, like other issues, probably less partisan throughout the state. But if we're looking at lawmakers, it's become a thing where Republicans are generally more supportive of expanding the voucher program, and Democrats are generally of the mindset that any expansion of that program leads to, you know, diminished services, diminished support for the public school system throughout the state. And so, you know, when it comes into budget debates like the current one, you're going to see that play out. And one of the early kind of starting points that that was laid down as a potential negotiation point was Republican leaders saying, well, you know, maybe Tony Evers, Democratic governor, wants more public school funding, and maybe, you know, we can get more expansion of vouchers as a sort of trade-off. And that's still at play. You know, the ultimate end goal for a lot of Republicans is to have a universal expansion of that that program, which is just not going to happen with a Democrat as governor. But the dynamic is still at play, because you will see some efforts to expand it with Republicans in charge of the legislature.
And I'm still trying to wrap my head around, what is the argument as to why that improves schools? Because I know I forgot exactly who you quoted in the article, but especially in comparison, we started off today's show talking about the suite of bills that are going to go through Florida, one of being universal school choice. And to a certain extent, I understand, well, kind of, the school choice that's happening in Florida, because it's a growing state, whereas Wisconsin is not, especially certain parts of Wisconsin is not. And so what is the outcome that the argument for people who are very pro school voucher that they think will be accomplished by doing this? Is it that all schools will get better?
Yeah, I mean, I'll let Scott speak to this probably in more detail, but yeah, it's the innovation argument, right? It's the marketplace argument, which exists not just in schools, but you know, that's the argument here is that if a private school can do it better, then A, students should have the right to go to that school. Parents should be able to choose the school that's best, you know, for their child in their mind, but also that if you start seeing more students going to those schools, public schools will be forced to improve themselves to be able to compete.
Yeah, it's very much a market-based argument that competition breeds innovation and improvement, and that the best will win out, and that if public schools want enrollment and students, then they need to do better, is the argument. And but what you mentioned about enrollment in Florida versus Wisconsin, I believe it was a quote from Mike Berry, who is the head of the state school Budget Administrators Association and a former Madison budget administrator and other school districts. And he talked about how with declining enrollment, the additional challenges that can create in expanding choice, right? So you have fewer and fewer students, the pie of students is getting smaller while the options, the pie tin for them to fill, keeps expanding, and the problems that can create. And so it is a pretty unique situation right now, I would say, given that balance.
We're talking to Scott Girard and Jesse Apoyan. Jesse Apoyan, who is the Capital Bureau Chief for the Cap Times, and Scott Girard, who is the Cap Times K-12 education reporter, about their article that I highly recommend reading if you're trying to wrap your head around school funding, what the negotiating chips are for the Wisconsin's budget negotiations that are happening right now. It's in the Cap Times. It was published February 1st, and I'll put it in today's show notes. But I guess coming back to more schools, more competition, and there is an argument. I you know, fundamentally, there's a part of me that understands the argument for that. But I think one of the things that I hadn't thought about that stuck out to me in the article is just the nature of fixed costs for any functioning school, that like a bus costs the same whether it's 60 kids or 70 kids, and that a decline of 100 kids across one elementary school maybe is 5 kids per class, which is not enough of a decline to not have that extra teacher. So you still need to pay for that teacher. And so the per pupil funding model, while maybe seems fair, doesn't necessarily understand the fixed costs. And even on top of that, the fact that how much more schools are supposed to be doing on top of what they maybe when we were all in school were doing when it comes to mental health and feeding kids and a lot of different things that we're relying on teachers and schools to now do. And so I guess, is that from the conservatives or the Republicans you've talked to, is there an understanding for of that, not even argument, of that reality?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a general understanding, I think, you know, pretty much across the board that is a thing that is true, and that is also a really difficult thing to adjust. You know, there's a reason why the school funding formula is hard for us to explain. You know, it's hard for legislators to explain too, and it's hard for them to figure out a better way to do it. You know, going back to that opening quote from Tony Evers, you know, trying to find that magic solution, and it's hard to reach it. So yeah, there's absolutely an acknowledgement, I think, that, you know, those fixed costs exist, and that's a challenge. There's also an acknowledgement that, you know, not having funding increases tied to inflation has created problems, but also that convincing anyone to start tying something to inflation after it hasn't been tied to inflation for a long time is a pretty big ask. I mean, we see that in the transportation funding debate too. You know, the gas tax, you know, increases could be indexed to inflation, but they're not. It's hard to convince people to do that. So I think there's a general agreement in some of these existing problems, and, you know, individual legislators hear from the teachers, the administrators, the school boards in their districts about these challenges. And the reality is also that, you know, those challenges are very different in different parts of the state. And so, you know, one legislator is hearing something about, you know, sparsity aid and hearing something about, you know, low enrollment districts, and other legislators are hearing about these, you know, giant urban centers that are having different challenges. So, you know, that's a long roundabout way of saying, yes, everyone's aware of these baseline problems, and I think they're hearing a lot about them, but figuring out how to solve them is a whole other ballgame.
All right. Well, when we come back from the next break, I want to talk more about the is more money the solution versus other reforms that are on the table, and how much we can try to summarize that in 8 minutes. But our guests are Scott Girard, who is the Cap Times K-12 education reporter, and Jesse Opoyan, who's the Capitol Bureau Chief, both for the Cap Times. Stick with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Got a heart that's strong, and a love that's tall. Ain't got no name, ain't got no fancy education, but I can see right through a powder face on a painted fool. Let me slip through.
Let me slip through.
Why you trying to hold me back? I'm just trying to move up front, little more this, little less of that.
Can you feel me?
Let me come through.
Let me come through.
I'm tired of being in the back. I'm just trying to move. Watch the ankles break. Whoa, whoa. I know you wish I.
Your mama pajama rolled out of bed and she ran to the police station.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere, and we are talking to Scott Girard, who is Cap Times K-12 education reporter, and Jesse Opoyan, who is the Cap Times Capitol Bureau Chief, about their article, which I highly recommend going back and reading, School Funding Hangs in the Balance of Wisconsin Budget Debate. And I think what I understand the crux of this to be is that Governor Evers, other Democrats, public school advocates basically argued that there needs to be more money and that we have underfunded schools. And Republicans, conservatives, maybe school voucher people have said, basically, we're already spending so much money and we're not seeing results. And so we need more reform. We need more reform on how we're doing math or reading and stuff like that. And so it feels to me like someone who does not have kids, and so I am still learning about this all the time, that it's a chicken or the egg, like false equivalency type thing of how can you say that more money wouldn't help when the people who were working in education say we need more money, but vice versa. How do you make sure that what they spend their money on is working? And so I don't even have a question there. I'll let you just say more about that juxtaposition.
Yeah. And this is something, I mean, this is what the entire debate over school funding is about. So yeah, we could talk for hours about this. You have one side, public school advocates, Democrats, talking about what they consider perpetual underfunding. And so the results that the other side uses to explain why they don't believe more money should be thrown at the problem, they say, well, those results are the result of underfunding. So of course, mm-hmm, the results are bad. But then the figures that we do spend on education, it is the largest part of the state's budget, are very large, you know, yeah, and whether that's large enough or not, they are just very large. And so looking at the budget, it is a big number. And so from the other side of the aisle, you have folks saying, well, look at this, the biggest part of our state budget, and it's not producing results. Why would we throw more into this? And so I don't know how you get it's sort of the sides arguing past each other on those points, right? I think no one agrees that like the results are great.
Yeah. Right. That's fact, right? That like we, yeah, from where we started, when we said we're all public school kids from Wisconsin. And when we were in school, Wisconsin schools were ranked a little bit higher, if not a lot higher, than they are currently.
Yeah. And frankly, especially for certain demographics, white, yeah, students, schools have been better for, and the achievement gaps in the state. And you can point to a lot of those things as examples of schools not working right now for a lot of students here. What the solution is to that is where the problem and the debate gets to. And it's complicated because the numbers are so big, because the system that funds it is so ingrained for three decades now. And is so complex. Jesse spoke to this earlier, but there's so many different pieces of this. So there is like normal state aid. There's also a categorical state aid, which goes outside of revenue limits. There's also special education reimbursement. There's also rural transportation aid. Like, there's all these different pieces of it. And so where you look to try to change on a systematic level, whether that's cutting funding or, you know, reallocating funding in what could be considered a more efficient way, or just adding funding, where do you add it? Where do you reallocate it from or to? So it's even once you get past that first, like, well, do I think there should be more or less? Mm-hmm. It's okay. Well, now which of this huge long list do we take from?
So I guess as we, yeah, at least it's not boring, right?
I will say there was a Blue Ribbon Commission that met on K-12 funding issues, and they came out with the report. I think it was in early 2019. They filed their long list of recommendations, many of which have not been acted on. And so a lot of advocates, and that was a bipartisan commission, included Republicans and Democrats, they did come up with a lot of recommendations that pointed to some of these issues. A lot of them have not been considered by the legislature at this point for a variety of reasons. So a lot of advocates will point to those recommendations and say, yes, it's really complicated. Here's a place to start. And we haven't yet.
We haven't done that part yet. Well, would you send me that blueprint? I'd love to put it in today's show notes and look at it. So then I guess coming back to the problem is the problem no matter what. But at least the problem in front of us is that we're going to have a budget. It's going to happen this year. So, Jesse, at least to wrap up this conversation, what do you think are the most likely negotiating chips from each side to get to something that hopefully, knock on wood, is a compromise that no one loves but people can live with?
Yeah, I mean, Tony Evers, the governor, has proposed $2.6 billion, and I can just about guarantee Republicans are not going to approve $2.6 billion.
That's a bet I'd be willing to take, and I don't bet often.
I'm gonna go with that. That being said, you know, they have said they want to spend a significant amount of money. The question is just what does significant mean to them? But, you know, rather than, I think, talking bargaining chips, I'm just going to say that the issues that I think that we're going to find the quickest agreement on are going to be increases to special education funding and increases to mental health programming. Again, will it look exactly like what the governor proposed in his budget? Probably not. Is that the easiest starting point in terms of agreement and immediacy of the problem? I think probably most people involved in the conversation would agree on that.
Well, that's good to hear as far as, because you said that in the article was basically the part of the mental health thing was not this is a more recent responsibility or at least starting place that people are seeing and necessary as we see these reports come out as far as how our teenagers and especially how our teenage girls are doing. But it is a whole new world as far as how schools are equipped to be able to deal with mental health. And so the fact that there could be some agreement on that, great. That is a relief. Let's hope. All right. Jesse Opoyan, Scott Girard, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I will link both that blueprint and your guys' article to today's show notes so people can go check that out. But thank you so much for your time and your work.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Well, that about does it for the noon hour. Thank you for listening. When we come back, what do you think of bare minimum Mondays? What are they? Do you think you could pull it off at your job? How much is Jane going to roll her eyes when I tell her what it is? Stick around. We will talk about it when we're back. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Now when the radical preach come to get me released, we is all on the cover and lose week. And I'm on my way. I don't know where I'm going. I'm on my way. I'm taking my time, but I don't know where. The queen of Corona. See you, me and Julio down by the schoolyard. See you, me and Julio down by the schoolyard. See you, me and Julio down by the schoolyard.